No, I think if we look that way, right, the sun's coming up over there, right? Mm-hmm. And probably it's going that way, so that north, must be north there. Right?
Yeah. But, all right, so that's east then.
Yeah.
Where the sun is.
Yeah.
And then that should be north.
Yeah, you'd think so. And then in which case we should be going that way, which is the way Matt said we should go. Mm-hmm. We should be going south, right?
I think so, yeah.
It's a red sky this morning. Shepherd's warning, it's going to rain. Oh, brilliant.
No. Oh, fantastic. Right, so where are we anyway?
Well, Matt said, didn't he? He said somewhere in the vicinity of Derwent Water.
Yeah.
Derwent Water. So, and he said if we carry on going south, we should end up in Bakewell.
Yeah. So we're headed. As long as they've got a tart waiting for us, I'm happy.
So. Bakewell pudding. Yeah, exactly. Bakewell
special pudding.
I'm really sore, actually. Matt's car is... Oh, it's no place to spend the night, I tell you that much.
Yeah, he just drove off. That's so rude.
He really did. Yeah, I don't think he was... I don't think he wanted to spend much more time with us.
Yeah.
So hang on a minute. So, okay, let's just walk in this direction. This must be
I'm going to check my phone, because the Google Maps should help, right?
Yeah, hopefully. This is the place... This is the place the Yorkshire Ripper used to frequent. Look, I'll tell you what, Izzy, enough of... Google Maps. If you probably haven't even got any signal. Look, I'm going to get out my Ordnance Survey map here from the 1980s.
Ordnance Survey map. Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's
you're
really
a typical millennial. You
typical
can't even
millennial.
Read a map.
Well, just because you're stuck in the previous century.
Well, I was born in the previous century.
Yeah, so was I. But
were
you? It's time to move on.
I never knew that. I would have thought you were.
Oh, God, there's no signal here.
Well, you're. I don't know where we are on my map, and you're, judging by your phone, you haven't got any signal. Can you see any signs of habitation at all?
Nope.
Any life forms?
I saw a deer earlier, but that's not really.
We might as well be on the moon.
Houston, we have a problem.
Actually, it's Houston, we've had a problem. It's always misquoted.
God, I can feel another lengthy explanation coming on. Actually, before you do that, should we just introduce the show?
And welcome to the Poetry Pod. My name is Izzy.
And I'm Orlando.
And we're two people who like poetry.
Love poetry.
Right. Who love poetry, and we want to share that love.
With you.
In our first season, we'll be looking at British culture through the lens of poetry. Welcome to the Poetry Pod. Season 1, Britain through the Bards. Yes, dear listener, welcome to our fourth episode of Poetry Pod.
I wandered lonely as a cloud. Well, now we know why Willie Wordsworth was wandering and why he was lonely. He was lost like we are, is he?
Yeah, and, you know, he must have had nicer weather. I can't even see any daffodils around here.
No chance of that.
Are we going to do that poem, or is that too
I think
obvious?
Let's
think about
it. I don't know about that. But I tell you what, it does have a rugged beauty, doesn't it?
The Peak certainly District. Rugged, yeah.
Yeah, certainly is. The Peak District, the land of the Bronte sisters, the land of Jane Austen, Pride and Prejudice.
Many writers, right? There's a couple of writers that have written about this landscape.
I guess so,
landscape.
Who springs to mind? If you think
George Eliot.
Okay.
Marian Evans.
Evans, true. Yeah. Samuel Johnson.
Ooh, the dictionary one.
Yeah, the dictionary guy. One, yeah, he liked it up here, that's for sure.
D.H. Lawrence.
Yes. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau was in exile here.
Oh.
Yeah.
Mon Dieu.
Mon Dieu, exactly. And John Ruskin, George Bernard Shaw. Oh. I mean, the list is endless.
Yeah. Have you heard of Celia Fiennes?
No, enlighten me.
She's a travel writer, a very early one, actually. She travelled in the 17th century.
Good
she travelled around England alone.
Really?
Which was quite unusual, both because she was a woman who travelled alone, but also because she was someone who travelled, which wasn't really common at the time.
That's
people didn't
highly unusual.
Travel for fun. So sometimes her family went with her, or relatives accompanied her, but most of the time it was just her and her two servants.
Okay.
And
her two servants and carrying her.
Carrying her on their shoulders. And she kept a journal about all the places she visited. And it wasn't published until 150 years after her death, but it was one of the first comprehensive surveys of England.
Really?
In a long time.
Celia Fiennes.
Celia Fiennes. And the journal's called Through England on a Side Saddle.
So. Okay, so she was riding, I'm imagining. Yeah, okay.
And, well, about Derbyshire, she wrote, quote, "All Derbyshire is full of steep hills, and nothing but the peaks of hills as thick one by another is seen in most of the county, which are steep, which makes travelling tedious," I mean, definitely right there, "and the miles long. You see neither hedge nor tree, but only low, dry stone walls round some ground. Else, it's only hills and dales as thick as you can imagine."
Well, nothing much has changed, has it?
Yeah, true.
Yeah, that was a sort of 400 years ago, and it's pretty much the same. Yeah, I mean, and she was followed by Daniel Defoe, Daniel Defoe, Robinson Crusoe fame. 30 years after that, he wrote his aptly named Tour Through the Whole Island of Great Britain.
Mm. Yeah.
So he was obviously one for advertising himself. Mm-hmm. He'll probably have to sell his books, didn't he?
Yeah.
And I don't think he was a great fan, because he basically described the Peak District as a howling wilderness.
Mm.
And he thought the people a rude and boorish kind of people.
Oh, dear. Well, I mean, I'd rather meet some of those rude and boorish kind of people, because they might at least tell us to get away from here.
Yeah, they'd be able to tell us the quickest way to get to a Bakewell pudding, for sure. Oh, God. And look now, perfect British weather. It started to hail.
Fantastic. I really don't feel inspired by all this. Like, all those literary figures must have been here in the summer.
They must have been here in the summer, yeah, because we've picked the wrong time of year, is he? Actually, this reminds me, and what does it remind me of? Of course, another Wordsworth poem, but not I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud. This one is called A Whirl Blast from Behind the Hill. A whirl blast from behind the hill rushed o'er the wood with startling sound. Then, all at once the air was still, and showers of hailstones pattered round. Where leafless oaks towered high above, I sat within an undergrove of tallest hollies, tall and green. A fairer bower was never seen. From year to year the spacious floor with withered leaves is covered o'er, and all the year the bower is green. But see, where'er the hailstones drop, the withered leaves all skip and hop. There's not a breeze, no breath of air, yet here and there and everywhere, along the floor beneath the shade, by those embowering hollies made, the leaves in myriads jump and spring, as if with pipes and music rare some Robin Goodfellow were there, and all those leaves in festive glee were dancing to the minstrelsy.
Ah, that's really nice, but I'm kind of... You know, I find it very difficult to stay as positive as Wordsworth is, right?
He found a lot of joy in pretty difficult circumstances, didn't he?
He must have caught a lot of colds.
He caught a lot
of attitude.
Yeah, I suspect so. He spent a very, very cold winter in Germany, actually, as well, thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the good thing about the British weather. Probably in 15 minutes, it'll be 10 degrees warmer.
True, yeah, but let's keep moving before we freeze to death around here.
Good idea. Mm. Yeah. Those fish and chips seem like a long time ago. We were whiling away the hours on Morecambe Beach, letting the radiation sink in. I'm not even in the mood for alliteration, is he?
Ooh, that is really bad. Oh, God. Well, would you like to hear an uplifting English travel poem?
What could be better?
Ah, this is The Rolling English Road by G.K. Chesterton. Before the Roman came to Rye or out to Sevenstrode, the rolling English drunkard made the rolling English road. A reeling road, a rolling road that rambles round the shire, and after him the parson ran, the sexton and the squire. A merry road, a mazy road, and such as we did tread, the night we went to Birmingham by way of Beachy Head. I knew no harm of Bonaparte and plenty of the squire, and for to fight the Frenchmen I did not much desire. But I did bash their baggonets, because they came arrayed to straighten out the crooked road an English drunkard made. Where you and I went down the lane with ale mugs in our hands, the night we went to Glastonbury by way of Goodwin Sands.
His sins, they were forgiven him. Or why do flowers run behind him, and the hedges all strengthening in the sun? The wild thing went from left to right and knew not which was which, but the wild rose was above him when they found him in a ditch. God pardon us, nor harden us, we did not see so clear. The night we went to Bannockburn by way of Brighton Pier. My friends, we will not go again, or ape an ancient rage, or stretch the folly of a youth to be the shame of age, but walk with clearer eyes and ears this path that wandereth, and see undrugged in evening light the decent inn of death. For there is good news yet to hear and fine things to be seen before we go to paradise by way of Kensal Green.
So that was G.K. Chesterton.
He obviously... Gilbert Keith.
Is his... oh, really?
Yeah, he looks a lot like a Gilbert Keith.
Mm-hmm. You, who'd have thought it? Yeah, he obviously got about as lost as we are now, didn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Didn't he used to, actually, I've heard this, didn't he sort of used to get lost on his way to do readings and things like that, and he'd have to telegram his wife to find out where he was supposed to be going?
Yeah, there was one time where he telegraphed her, and he was like, I'm not sure where I'm supposed to be, and she just replied... home.
I know the feeling. I feel exactly like that as well. Yeah. Yeah, she must have got very annoyed.
Yeah.
So, yes. Hey. It's not somebody sitting over there. Look, there's someone sitting over there.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it is. Yes. Let's go ask him. He knows.
Well,
be careful.
Remember, this is the sort of place the Yorkshire Ripper used to frequent.
Yeah, it'll be fine. Hello there. Hi.
Good morning.
Hi. Sorry, do you happen to know where we are?
We've got lost.
Yeah.
Where do you want to be?
Well,
be the question.
We are aware of the fact that we are somewhere on the Peak District. I've got a big Ordnance Survey map here. Hang on a sec. Let me just put it in front of you. So we were told we're somewhere near Derwent Water. Maybe you can show where we are. We're actually supposed to be trying to go down to Bakewell.
The thing is, I don't really know where we are, but it doesn't really matter because we are somewhere around here. And if you go here, all you have to do is walk.
Okay. Thanks.
Cool.
Yeah, that's
right. Brilliant. Can I ask you a personal question? You don't sound...
Sure.
You're not from round here, as they say, are you? Are you from round here?
No, I'm not. I'm not British at all. I'm. I happen to be German.
You're German.
I picked up a teensy accent. That's what I actually should sound like. I'm sorry. Just trying to pretend to be somebody else.
If you'd just done that from the very beginning, we'd have known immediately. But you cunningly disguised your accent.
I'm very sorry. I was sleeping when you talked to me. I'm sorry.
So what are you doing in Britain? What's your link to the UK?
I'm actually a quite non-famous poet.
Oh.
Nobody should know me. Yes, I do write a lot of poetry, especially as I'm very fond of English poetry, American as well to a certain extent, but English has the priority. And yes, that's what I do.
What's your name? I mean, given the fact that you're not famous, then obviously we'd never have heard of you, but we'd like to have heard of you. So what's your name?
My name is John Schogen. So it's kind of a British-German combination, and it helps me in both countries.
Very good. What kind of things have you written?
I have written a lot of, I guess I started out at university when I was still a student. I wrote a lot of sonnets about silly topics like love, darkness, death, funny things.
So happy things, basically.
Happy things like the Iraq War, yes, 2003, I remember that. Just the other day, I reread it. So these are basically, I'm a very huge fan of Shakespeare's and Poe's, and those are basically my sources.
Well, that's an amazing coincidence. We are also big, big fans of Shakespeare, aren't we, Izzy?
Yeah, we are.
We've read enough of him on our show already. Well, we're doing a poetry podcast. So that is an extraordinary coincidence, which I'm sure.
Inky dinky, lovely.
Exactly, I'm sure our listeners will agree that that is an amazing coincidence. What are the major differences for you between the English and the Germans? What would you say, being an Anglophile as you are?
The people or the language?
Both.
Coming to the language, I find that the English language is, I find it much more to the point than the German language, especially when it comes to poetry, because English words are sometimes, well, very often shorter, and you can get to the point, really. Whereas sometimes I find the English people, on the other hand, sometimes tend to sugarcoat words and expressions and what they mean, whereas the Germans are quite direct. And but the German poetry,
I'm not really 100% sure what you mean.
Well, they say things like, it's not bad at all, when they mean it's awful.
That's very true. That's very true. Izzy, would you concur with that, Izzy?
Yes. I am German after
all. Izzy agrees. Izzy agrees with that. John, seeing as we bumped into you like this, have you got a poem that you'd like to share with us?
Actually, I do. Yes, I have it somewhere. It's like I prepared something, but I didn't prepare because I never prepare. Yes, I do.
Yeah, and what's the name of the poem?
The Army in the Snow.
The Army in the Snow. Well, here it is for our listeners.
The army in the snow. The rolling hills, the lavish dales, the mountain peaks and hidden trails that shape the face of Albion have vanished and are long since gone. Old Man Winter conquered all the beauty of a golden fall. He spread his shroud of ivory snow to suffocate the life below. A snow-swept path I walked alone. With every step the ground would groan. The footprints that I left behind no human soul would ever find. I walked along a frozen lake. I threw a stone the ice would shake. Then faced the path that I pursued and slunk back into solitude. I walked alone in desolation, and happened on a tree formation. This gnarly army left to die enthralled my frost-contorted eye. I saw them through my icy breath, these fearsome harbingers of death induced in me a feel of dread. They lived in spring, and now seem dead. In autumn nature's beauty dies, and yet in spring it will arise. When I touch winter, I'll be gone from the face of Albion. I turned around and walked away into a future ever grey, the snowflakes falling silently on every branch of every tree.
John, that was fantastic. Izzy, what did you think of that?
Yeah, great poem. Really enjoyed it.
So have you?
It was awful.
You thought it was awful. Okay, said in true German tradition of honesty and directness. So you've published poems? That's right. Is that right? Where can we find them?
You can find them. I think they are no longer printed, but you can still find some on Amazon, and I think Booklooker, which is a webpage that sells used books.
Very good.
There are two volumes. One is called Autumn Recordings. It's one from 2010, I think. And the other one is called Brennende Flügel, which is a mixture of German and English poems. The other one is entirely English. It was published in 2006, I think, and you can still find it. You can still find the odd copy on Amazon or I think some used books sellers online.
If you're a fan of Shakespeare, you must also be a fan of the theatre. Are you theatrically inclined?
Absolutely. I do have my own theatre group, which is called the Dead Parrot Theatre, nudge, nudge. And,
inspired by Monty Python, by any chance?
Sort of. There's also one. My second son is called Monty. You don't know that, by the way, but now you know. He really is. And yes, I have this group, and I write plays for it. The other day, 2 years ago, we did, for instance, a play on Jack the Ripper. We did a fictitious Shakespeare biography. We did an Edgar Allan Poe biography. We did comedies, ghosts, English ghost stories, and so on and so forth.
It's ironic that you mention Jack the Ripper. I was just warning Izzy before she came to talk to you about the Yorkshire Ripper.
So. Yes, the funny thing is, I was actually the other day, I was reading a book about the Yorkshire Ripper and thought about putting it into a play. I'm not quite sure about it, but rather not his work, work.
Is that why we found you here up on in the middle of the Peak District? Are you doing a sort of bit of research up here?
Yes, I'm trying to get in the mood. Yes.
I think perhaps now might be a good time to leave. What do you think, Izzy?
Yeah. So, John, what do you think? Which direction should we be heading to get to Bakewell?
Backwards. Just turn back and run.
Turn back and run. Okay, not quite the help we were looking for. That was a very English way of saying thanks for nothing, mate. Well, it's really nice meeting you. And yeah, thank you very much for your poem. And yeah, maybe good luck with all of your rather morbid research.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Turn back and run. Okay, I'm not going to do any running. Are you going to do any running?
No, I'm good. Yeah, no. That didn't really help.
Didn't really go as well as we'd expected, but yeah. We did meet an interesting person.
Yeah, he didn't murder us, so that's a bonus.
Certainly, as he turned out not to be the Yorkshire Ripper, but where the hell should we go?
Let's just keep walking that way.
That way, brilliant. Well, I tell you what, it's lucky we didn't meet the Yorkshire Ripper, but this is Derbyshire, not Yorkshire. With apologies to Yorkshire, of course.
I think we can cross Yorkshire off our list now, you know. They won't be too happy about you slandering their name.
No, I'll probably be lynched. Okay, we'll not go to Yorkshire, then we better carry on heading south.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you what, while we're walking, we don't seem to be getting anywhere particularly fast here, why don't we do a little quiz?
Ooh.
I've got some interesting facts about the Peak District, and I would like you to tell me whether or not they are true. Okay?
Six facts about
the Peak District.
Right.
And you have to tell me if they're true. And I'm going to make it a little bit difficult in that I'm going to sort of make sort of this detail slightly wrong. All right. I'll just leave them as they are.
Right.
Okay, here's question one. The Peak District was officially the second UK national park established in 1951. True or false?
1951. That sounds wrong to me. It must have been 1851. So I say it's false, and I think it was the first one as well, so I'm going to go for false.
You're right in a sense, because it is false, but you're wrong about why it's false. The Peak District was officially the first UK
there
national park,
mm-hmm.
but it was established in 1951.
1951.
It's the very first. Interesting fact, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So I'll give you half a point.
But I also mentioned that was the first. I did mention that. But
did
anyway.
You? Did you?
I did.
Ah, okay.
I did. I said, and also I think it was the first.
Okay, in that case, yeah, but that's the half point.
Okay, I'm going to be as strict with you.
Oh, yeah,
feel free. All right.
The Peak District covers five counties. Five counties. True or false?
Ooh, I think it's more than that. I'll go for false.
False?
Yeah.
It's true, I'm afraid. It covers Derbyshire, Cheshire, Staffordshire, Yorkshire, and Greater Manchester.
Mm.
I didn't realise Greater Manchester was a county, actually, but there we are. Interesting. Okay. Tell me whether this is true or false. This is an interesting fact, but one that I may have made up.
Mm-hmm.
There are no sharp mountain peaks in the Peak District. The name is thought to derive from Pecksaetan, an Anglo-Saxon tribe who settled in the area.
I know that second half is true. I'm not sure whether there's zero sharp peaks, but I know the name comes from that tribe. So I'll go for true, and if you say false, I'm just going to be mad at you.
Well, okay. That's two very good motivations for me to say that it is true, because it is true.
All right.
So you've got one and a half points. You're doing very well. Okay, right. Question number four. There is a cave called the Devil's Arse near Castleton, and it's called the Devil's Arse because of the flatulent sounding noises from inside the cave when flood water is draining away. True or false?
I want that to be true, so I'm going to go, yes, it's true.
You're right, it is true.
Great.
I want it to be true as well. The Devil's Arse. Yeah, the way we keep walking, we may very well find the Devil's Arse.
Mm.
We're in the arse end of nowhere anyway. Very good, Izzy. So two and a half. No?
Mm-hmm.
Next question. In 1669, the village of Evam, I'm assuming it's pronounced Evam or Evam, had to self-quarantine to prevent the spread of the bubonic plague after a flea-infested bundle of cloth arrived from London.
Yes, that's true. I read that one. Yeah, that is also true.
You know it.
My research paid off.
It has, but I can only give you half a point because I actually changed the date.
Oh, fair enough.
1665.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. But I've got three points.
Half a point. You've got 3 points.
Cool.
You've got 3 points. Yeah, and okay, so this is the very, very last question now. Chance for you to get up to 4. This is an open question.
Ooh.
What relationship, seeing as you've done your homework, what relationship does Robin Hood have with the Peak District?
That's not in the Wikipedia article, so I don't know.
Think of his merry men.
I mean,
Which of his merry men do you know? Do you know any of his merry men?
Yeah, no, I don't know.
Okay, I'll tell you. One must say, despite a lack of historical evidence for his existence, Robin Hood's friend Little John is reputed to be buried in a churchyard in the village of Hathersage, Derbyshire. Hathersage, I think, also where Bronte House is, if my research is correct. So there we are. You've done
3 out of 6.
3 out of 6, and they were tricky questions.
Too bad.
I mean, I was
not
a bit
bad.
I was
and
a
technically,
bit
you could argue for 3.5 out of 6, but fair enough.
You could. Hang on a minute.
Yeah.
Hang on a minute. This tree looks strangely familiar.
It's a tree. They all sort of look the same.
No. This is where we started from. See, recognize that gnarled stump.
Yeah, that's the same tree.
Oh, God. This is like being becalmed at sea. I feel like the Ancient Mariner.
Yeah.
We haven't even killed any albatrosses.
Yeah, or any of the deer.
No, quite not yet, anyway.
That's disappointing.
Izzy, we must do what all Brits do in this kind of situation.
Well, panic, call a mountain rescue.
That's what we do in Germany. No, we are going to have a cup of tea.
Oh, that's a good idea. Good thing you filled up your thermos before we left Morecambe.
It certainly is. Yeah, have a cup. This view is very inspiring, though, isn't it? I feel like singing Jerusalem.
Yeah. Oh, actually, it reminds me of a poem by Edith Nesbit.
Edith Nesbit.
Mostly famous for her children's books, right?
Yeah.
But she also wrote poetry.
Did she?
Yeah.
Okay. What does it remind you of?
It's a poem very aptly called England.
Okay.
It's about the English countryside.
Yeah.
So here we go.
Lovely.
Edith Nesbit, England. Shoulders of upland brown lay dark to the sunset's bosom, living amber of wheat and copper of new ploughed loam. Downs where the white sheep wander, little gardens in blossom, roads that wind through the twilight up to the lights of home. Lanes that are white with hawthorn, dykes where the sedges shiver, hollows where caged winds slumber, moorlands where winds wake free. Sowing and reaping and gleaning, spring and torrent and river, are they not more by worlds than the whole of the world can be? Is there a corner of land, first fringed rag of a byway, coin of your foam-white cliffs or swirl of your grass-green waves, leaf of your peaceful copse or dust of your strenuous highway, but in our hearts is sacred, dear as our cradles, our graves? Is not each bough in your orchards, each cloud in the skies above you, is not each byre or homestead, furrow or farm or fold, dear as the last dear drops of the blood in the hearts that love you, filling those hearts till the love is more than the heart can hold?
Oh, that really encapsulates the beauty and the romantic attachment the Brits have for the landscape.
Very patriotic, right?
It's very patriotic, isn't it? Yeah.
I mean, it's called England.
It certainly is. Doesn't leave much room for interpretation. That was a beautiful poem. Mm. Edith Nesbit, E. Nesbit, I always remember when I was growing up, The Railway Children. The Railway Children was a sort of big children's book. When I was growing up. Yeah, amazing. I didn't realize she wrote poetry.
Yeah, right. It's great. Hey, here's a thought. Why don't we get a bit creative while we drink our tea? How about writing a haiku?
That's a nice idea.
Right?
A haiku, yeah. You mean a haiku as in the sort of original Japanese poem with a very strict meter, five syllables, seven syllables, five syllables, to do, set in the present tense, to do with natural themes and the seasons.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was just thinking, you know, five syllables, seven syllables, five syllables, but sure.
Yeah, but don't forget the concrete imagery, seasonal reference, and yeah, okay. How about a haiku about getting lost?
Ooh, okay, sure.
Okay, let's sit down, have a cup of tea, and write a quick haiku. I've got a good one here already, I think. Mm-hmm. Hang on, five, seven, okay. And five.
All right, I've got one.
Okay.
All right, here's mine. The signpost is bent. I don't know where I should turn. Left, right, north, or east?
Yeah, very good. You did that very fast. I would recommend south, but there we are. Okay, here's mine. A sprig of heather. The same one I saw before. I'll turn left next time.
Yeah. Okay. Should we try that? Should we try turning left this time?
Well, we went right last time, so why don't we carry on going left? Yeah.
All right, let's keep going.
If in doubt, try something new.
Yeah.
Gosh, I keep going around these sort of turns here. I keep expecting to see the Hound of the Baskervilles around the corner. Okay. Are you a fan of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle?
I've read some of the stories,
Yeah. Yeah, they're very macabre, aren't they? It's just beginning to get a bit dark now, so I'm getting slightly concerned that we will... be benighted, as one says. You know, another person who, you mentioned Celia Fiennes, there was another advocate of travelling around, but also holidaying at home. It was a 19th century English author and poet, and also a lady, Eliza Cook. Mm. And I believe, did we have her on our last episode?
No, we didn't, but we talked about the Sea Child when we were researching the other episode.
And that was from her, was it?
Yeah, that was her. Yeah.
And she said, and it's a very short quote, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing this correctly. This is a place in the Peak District. And Monsel, thou mine of Arcadian treasure, need we seek for Greek islands and spice-laden gales, while a temple like thee of enchantment and pleasure may be found in our own native Derbyshire dales.
Mm.
There we are. So she's basically saying, we don't need to go to Greece. Don't need your package tour to Mykonos. Stay here. It's much more beautiful.
Mm, definitely. Oh, careful there. It's a large twig.
Oh, my ankle. That hurt.
Oh, God, are you okay?
Oh, I think so. Twigs are larger than they used to be. Must be a Bakewell twig. Mm. Yeah, just let me... Hang on a second. I'm just going to sit down for a second. Nurse my ankle.
Oh, man. Do you want to hear a poem while you're waiting?
That's your answer to everything.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, I haven't got a first aid kit, so I've got nothing better to do.
Can't run away from me now.
I can't run away from you now. No, exactly. A captive audience.
And you know, you might actually relate to this poem because it was written by Coleridge when he was confined to sit at home because his wife accidentally spilled boiling milk over his foot.
I see. Did she do it on purpose, do you think?
Probably. Maybe he was like walking around doing too many poems. He just wanted to enjoy the countryside.
Like G.K. Chesterton. He was away too much, was he?
So
isn't as long as the Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, is it?
It is, but I'm only going to do, like, just stop me.
Okay.
All his friends and his wife went out on adventures and walks, basically. And he was sitting at home and he was getting a bit melodramatic, really, about the whole sitting. Yeah. So I thought you might enjoy that one.
All right.
The current situation.
Well, my ankle is hurting, so off you go.
Right. This lime tree bower, my prison. Well, they are gone, and here must I remain, this lime tree bower, my prison. I have lost beauties and feelings, such as would have been most sweet to my remembrance, even when age had dimmed mine eyes to blindness. They, meanwhile, friends whom I never more may meet again, on springy heath, along the hilltop edge, wander in gladness, and wind down, perchance, that still roaring dell of which I told, the roaring dell, wooded, narrow, deep, and only speckled by the midday sun, rich slim trunk the ash from rock to rock flings arching like a bridge, that branchless ash, unsunned and damp, whose few poor yellow leaves never tremble in the gale, yet tremble still fanned by the waterfall. And there, my friends, behold the dark green file of long, lank weeds that all at once, a most fantastic sight, still nod and drip beneath the dripping edge of the blue clay stone. Oh, come on. I'm not saying you're as melodramatic as Coleridge. I'm just...
No. I think I can hear footsteps. Yeah, look. Someone's coming.
Oh, true. Oh, is that... a Victorian dress she's wearing.
My God.
Indeed it is. Would you like me to say a few words about my dress? Because I can see you looking very surprised.
We are extremely surprised. Yeah, very, very surprised indeed. Yeah. Oh, well, please, yes.
Oh, well, I'll gladly let you in on some intel here. So this dress, as you can see, is... combined with a pair of big baggy trousers gathered at the ankle and covered by a long split skirt. It guarantees mobility, comfort, and propriety, while normally a Victorian lady usually could only have one of these at a time. I was, as a matter of fact, inspired by the famous traveler Mary Kingsley, who, in her travels in West Africa, spoke of the blessings of a good thick skirt. I'm quoting here. In her best-known sketch, and one that has been used as a sort of defining moment for all 19th-century women travelers, Mary Kingsley describes falling into a jaguar pit trap onto the points of spats. Ouch. She survives, she claims, because her voluminous, heavy skirt protected her from any harm. In her words, it is at these times you realize the blessings of a good thick skirt. Had I paid heed to the advice of many people in England who ought to have known better and did not do it themselves and adopted masculine garments, I should have been spiked to the bone and done for. Whereas, save for a good many bruises, here I was with the fullness of my skirt tucked under me, sitting on 9 ebony spikes, some 12 inches long, in comparative comfort, howling lustily to be hauled out. That's one hell of a lady, isn't it? Well, definitely.
Certainly. So that's is that why you are wearing these clothes, as a sort of precaution?
Absolutely. You can't be safe enough, right? Even in those days.
Yeah, and I guess there are a lot of jaguars here on the Peak District.
You just never know. You never know. You can't be sure. Even if it's just, you know, a big tiger who looks like a cat, you can't be sure.
Very true. If I'd been wearing one of your dresses, I probably wouldn't have slipped over and twisted my ankle.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean...
it's always better to take things slow.
That's very true. Would you say that, you know, taking things slow, that's idleness is a virtue?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that. Being idle, can actually be very eye-opening and empowering. Actually, it makes you see so much more. In today's capitalistic society, everything seems to be about being faster and more efficient than the others. But why? Already, the American writer Herman Melville created one of the first no-sayers and the first idlers in his short story, Bartleby the Scrivener. The clerk Bartleby, when asked to do anything at all, really, always answers, "I prefer not to." That's some great honesty that we need more of, isn't it? In fact, we can look to be inspired by other mammals than ourselves. For instance, the sloth. I'm writing a cultural history of the sloth at the moment together with my colleague, Tobias Keiling. The book will come out in autumn this year. And in German, mind that the word Faultier is one of the few disparaging descriptions of an animal, lazy animal. Why not call it sleepy animal? I think people are a little jealous of that furry friend. Anyway, for a long time, until the 19th century, in fact, Europeans did not know much about this animal since they live in the rainforests in South America. Scientists such as Charles Darwin and Richard Owen brought back some information about this animal and its scary predecessor, the Megatherium, which was as big as a dinosaur, back to Europe. Wow. So you can imagine that people found that weird and fascinating in the middle of the industrialization, which was precisely not about being slow and sleepy. The sloth is taking even slowness to an extreme, though, if that makes sense, a little oxymoronic. It sleeps for about 20 hours a day and only leaves its spot up in the trees once per week to, well, defecate. More climbs or hikes would be too dangerous since it couldn't run away from its predators. Fascinating animal.
It really is fascinating. Yeah. Who would have thought we would have met such a knowledgeable person up here in the middle of the Peak District?
Yeah, it's remarkable. I did not expect that. Brilliant. So you just mentioned you'll be publishing a book about the sloth. So maybe some introduction about ourselves. We talk a lot about poetry. Do you happen to write any poetry yourself?
I do, yeah. I mean, as you can tell, since I like to take things slow, I don't engage in very long, like, oratoriums or whatever. I prefer short, clipped poems, such as haikus. Mm. I mean, I don't know, would you like me to read out a couple?
Absolutely, or? Yeah. It's funny you should mention that, because we were talking about haikus earlier.
Great!
So, yeah, absolutely, fire away.
Oh, great. So this is really just a random selection. Since I like to sleep in, I'm usually late. So sometimes, you know, the boundaries between being awake and being asleep blur. And a while ago, I wrote the following. Lacking sleep means to get on the wrong tram home and notice it too late. That's one.
Nice one.
And then a more general one, since I spent a lot of time on trains and on trams. Feeling haiku means sitting in a crowded tram counting syllables. I still do that. It calms me down, you know, especially when it's really crowded. And since I'm rather short, there's usually people blocking my view. So what I do is count syllables. Great
fun.
That
was a sort of meta haiku, wasn't it?
It is, yeah. And just a final one, which has a sort of punchline in the third line, if you want.
Oh.
Still twigs in my hair. And gazillions of scratches. Hedge jumping is fun.
Very nice. Yeah, brilliant. I've been doing some hedge jumping myself. That's why I'm lying here with a twisted ankle.
Yeah, and twigs in your hair. You?
And twigs in my hair, exactly. Well, what's left of my hair? I haven't got much left.
But I'm sure it was worth it.
So tell me, have you obviously read a lot about the sloth. Have you ever traveled to South America to meet one yourself?
Unfortunately not, but it's definitely on my bucket list. But as you say, I've read about it quite a bit. And for instance, have you ever heard of William Henry Hudson?
No,
not the explorer who discovered Hudson Bay.
Well, no, but also an explorer. So maybe the Hudsons are a particularly adventurous bunch. The one I've got in mind was a British explorer and ornithologist, and he was supposed to research birds for the Royal Zoological Society in the 1870s in Patagonia, so that's a region at the southern end of South America. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to do that because he got injured badly on the very first day of his trip, and he had to stay in bed. So he still tried to make the most out of his stay there, and he imagined what it would be like to travel and to research birds. For him, definitely, it wasn't a disadvantage to lie in bed, though. So another fervent supporter of idleness and of being idle.
One day, while listening to the silence, it occurred to my mind to wonder what the effect would be if I were to shout aloud. In that novel state of mind I was in, thought had become impossible. Elsewhere I had always been able to think most freely on horseback, but now, with a horse under me, I had become incapable of reflection. My mind had suddenly transformed itself from a thinking machine into a machine for some other unknown purpose. To think was like setting in motion a noisy engine in my brain, and there was something there which bade me be still, and I was forced to obey. My state was one of suspense and watchfulness, yet I had no expectation of meeting with an adventure, and felt as free from apprehension as I feel now when sitting in a room in London. The change in me was just as great and wonderful as if I had changed my identity for that of another man or animal. The state seemed familiar rather than strange, and although accompanied by a strong feeling of elation, I did not know it, did not know that something had come between me and my intellect, until I lost it and returned to my former self, to thinking and the old insipid existence. I would always quit the locals without regret to lie on the green sward, to gaze up into the trees or the blue sky and speculate on all imaginable things. The result was that when no longer any excuse for inaction existed, use had bred a habit in me, the habit of indolence, which was quite common among the people of Patagonia and appeared to suit the genial climate. And this habit, a temper of mind, I retained, with occasional slight relapses, during the whole period of my stay. Our waking life is sometimes like a dream, which proceeds logically enough until the stimulus of some new sensations, from without or within, throws it into temporary confusion or suspends its action, after which it goes on again, but with fresh characters, passions, and motifs, and a changed argument.
That's wonderful. Thank you. Yes, well, you're clearly not idle yourself. You've been walking around wearing your Victorian costume. It looks absolutely fantastic. We actually are a bit lost. Can you help us? We're actually supposed to be heading south in the direction of Bakewell. Could you have a quick look at our map and maybe tell us which direction to go in?
Yeah, okay. I think you need to turn to the left and then walk, if you can. I mean, walk slowly.
Hobble.
Hobble for about 20 meters, then rest on a bench. Mm-hmm. There is a bench.
For about 3 days.
Yeah, and then I think it should be to your right. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Left, and then
left,
right.
Rest, and then right. Yeah.
Rest. Then to the right.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Sounds...
We'll give that a try.
We'll give
right.
it a whirl.
Fantastic.
Hopefully it turns out better than last time.
Last time, yeah. Thank you so much for your many explanations. We're definitely going to, you know, try and keep the spirit of idleness in our souls.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you and good luck. And remember to take it slow, step by step.
We will. No danger of going quickly now, I think.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
So, hang on a minute, Izzy. If I'm right, didn't she say so?
Left.
To the left,
and then
have
rest.
A rest, and then to the right. That's equally unhelpful.
Exactly. Yeah. Should we just keep walking that way?
Let's do that.
Yeah.
We're two fascinating people, but utterly hopeless in terms
utterly
of direction
hopeless.
Finding.
Yeah, absolutely.
Utterly hopeless.
Right. So, do you want to hear my quiz?
I certainly do.
Right.
I certainly do.
I've only got 5 questions, but I've got 1 option to get an extra point for you, so you could...
Very nice. So I've got a bonus point.
Yeah,
you
can get a bonus point. All right. So this quiz is about the National Trust.
Okay, the National Trust.
Yeah, because I
we
felt
met
like...
a National Trust poet, didn't we?
Yeah. That's Rowan McCabe at Wordsworth House, was it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Right. So I figured, you know, National Trust, walking, rambling, idling would be perfect.
Very good.
Okay, question 1. When was the National Trust founded?
Oh, that's a tricky one. I can't... If I get it within sort of 20 years?
10 years.
National Trust. Okay, let me think. I suspect that it's a relatively modern phenomenon, so I'm probably wrong when I say that, but I would go for 1930.
Ooh, no, it is quite a bit older. It was founded in 1895.
Wow, 1895. Yeah. Good. I'm writing this down because I'm actually very interested in that. 1895, okay.
Mm-hmm. And the first property they bought was Elphriston Clergy House in Sussex.
Trust and Clergy House. Okay, very interesting. Yeah. Okay. It's a fantastic institution, the National Trust.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So I'm not doing very well.
Right. Question two.
Yeah.
Can you name one of the top 10 most visited properties?
Of the National Trust?
Of the National Trust.
Top 10?
Yeah, any one of the top 10.
Probably something that's appeared in film would be my guess. Mm-hmm. So, and I know that Highclere Castle, I don't think is part of the National Trust because that's on, that was Downton Abbey, but so it wouldn't be that. So I think something like, let me guess, let me go for, actually there's a place here that appeared in Pride and Prejudice. I'm grasping at straws.
Would you like a hint?
Please give me a hint.
Two of them, of the top 10, are actually in Northern Ireland.
In Northern Ireland?
Yeah.
Does one of them begin with Bally something?
No.
Okay, well, that's the end of my
natural
idea.
Natural sites rather than houses, because the National Trust also owns a lot of land.
Okay, now put me out of my misery, Izzy.
Right, number one is Giant's Causeway.
Giant's Causeway?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't realise they owned sort of natural places as well.
Yeah. Okay. Carrick Reed also right there. No, kind of rope
didn't know
bridge.
That either. Okay.
Yeah. And a couple of houses. Clumber Park.
No, don't know that either.
Attingham Park.
Don't know that either.
Just like big
terrible
houses.
Gosh, I'm more ignorant than I thought.
Mm-hmm.
You're putting me to shame. Okay, so zero out of two. Carry on.
Question number three.
Yeah.
Which county has the most National Trust properties?
Okay, I'm going to say, you know what I think? I think it might be Kent.
That's what I thought as well, but it's not even in the top three.
Really?
Yeah.
No, go on.
Somerset.
Somerset?
Yeah.
And to think that I grew up next to Somerset and I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
I thought this is going very badly for me. Okay, Carol, so 0 out of 3.
Right. Question number four. What percentage of the UK coast is owned by the National Trust?
What percentage of the UK coast is... Okay, it must be a surprising amount. Let me say 55%.
Too much.
How much?
It's 10%.
10%,
okay. So it's 780 miles out of roughly 7,800.
Still
miles.
Quite a lot, though, isn't
quite
it?
Quite a lot, 10%. Yeah, I was surprised.
These are interesting facts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, carry on. So I don't mind losing if it means I learn something.
Exactly,
that's good.
Right. All right, question number five, and I think you might know that one. In which Jane Austen adaptation can you see the National Trust property, Lyme Park?
Lyme Park. Well, I'm assuming, it must be Pride and Prejudice, surely.
Which one?
Do you mean which?
Which adaptation?
Which adaptation? I think it's probably the BBC, the famous BBC series with Colin Firth. And am I right?
Correct.
Yes.
Yes.
Very good.
Right.
At
you
last.
Get the bonus point there.
Do I get a bonus point?
Yes. Fantastic. You get 2 points. I've got 3 two. Points. So
yeah,
I can
exactly.
Just be
so
generous.
You can afford to be generous, can't you? Fantastic.
Ooh.
Thank you for that. I feel enlightened.
Brilliant. All right. Oh, hold on. Isn't this where we met John?
Oh, no. This is like an episode of The Prisoner.
Yeah, Castaway.
We're stuck in the infamous Peak District Triangle.
Yeah. And we're out of tea. I mean, this is getting pretty serious.
It's actually turning into a bit of an epic, isn't it?
Yeah.
The sun is setting, but I tell you what, I'm not in the mood for Tennyson now.
Yeah, or a haiku.
There's
nothing to see. You can't be very concrete if you can't see anything.
This reminds me, actually, of a poem by a poet called Charlotte Mew, 1869 to 1928.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting poet. I'll talk a little bit about her afterwards. But the poet is called Moorland Knight, which I thought would be quite apt for this situation. Mm-hmm. My face is against the grass. The moorland grass is wet. My eyes are shut against the grass. Against my lips there are the little blades. Over my head the curlews call, and now there is the night wind in my hair. My heart is against the grass and the sweet earth. It has gone still at last. It does not want to beat any more, and why should it beat? This is the end of the journey. The thing is found. This is the end of all the roads. Over the grass there is the night dew and the wind that drives up from the sea along the moorland road. I hear a curlew start out from the heath and fly off calling through the dusk, the wild, long, rippling call. The thing is found, and I am quiet with the earth. Perhaps the earth will hold it, or the wind, or that bird's cry. But it is not for long in any life I know. This cannot stay, not now, not yet, not in a dying world, with me for very long. I leave it here. And one day the wet grass may give it back. One day the quiet earth may give it back. The calling birds may give it back as they go by, to someone walking on the moor who starves for love and will not know who gave it to all these to give away. Or, if I come and ask for it again, oh, then to me. So that was Charlotte Mary Mew. Oh,
Charlotte when did Mary she live Mew. Again?
Yeah, so 1869 to 1828.
Because it sounds really modern, doesn't it? Because it doesn't rhyme, it doesn't have a sort of metric.
It's very free, isn't it? It's very free. And actually she was, a lot of people were very big fans of hers, and big literary figures were big fans of hers. Right. Thomas Hardy, who called her the best woman poet of her day, Virginia Woolf. Thought she was very good at very good and interesting and quite unlike anyone else. Siegfried Sassoon, John Masefield, Walter de la Mare are all fans.
Well, yeah, understandably. I mean, this is it sounds very sort of inventive. Virginia Woolf did very unlike other poetry at the time.
Absolutely, and you know, it's quite a trailblazer actually in many regards. And she, I mean, like a lot of the poets we've mentioned on our show, she had a bit of a tragic life. She was born into a family, half of whom were committed to mental institutions. And her sister, when her sister died of cancer, she also was put into a went into a deep depression and went into a nursing home. And unfortunately, then she committed suicide.
Oh dear.
So she was. But she was a sort of postmodernist or a proto-modernist in form and atmosphere, and she was very experimental in her use of her sort of prose-like prose-like poetry and forms of enjambement, indentation, and all that kind of thing. So very very interesting.
Interesting, but I still can't really see any sign of habitation around here.
We're not doing very well. We're not going to make it to London, are we?
True,
we're supposed to actually forget about Bakewell. How on earth are we going to get to London for our next episode? We're supposed to be at the Imperial War Museum tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
Ah! Oh, God. Wolves!
Wolves? Is that the thing Charlotte Mew was talking about?
Well, it's not a curlew, that's for sure. And it's certainly not the Hound of the Baskervilles. That's on Dartmoor.
Oh, man, that's pretty scary. Oh, wait. I can see lights moving over there.
It's a road. Thank God. Let's get going, Izzy. Come on. It must be, it's 2 miles away. But if we get there, we can hitch to London from there.
Brilliant, And we didn't even need your map.
Even need your GPS, just your fantastic eyesight. Yeah.
Right, good. Let's keep going. Shall we do a poem to pass the time?
Yeah. Go on.
All right.
Yep, two miles of poem.
Right.
What should we read?
Of course.
It has to be, doesn't it? Okay.
I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a...
Oh, no! There they are again. Oh, God, they're getting closer. Izzy, run.
Well, you're the one to talk. You're only hobbling at about 2 miles per hour.
My ankle is hurting. My ankle's hurting.
Just hurry up.
Look, just leave me behind. You're faster.
Don't get ready.
Leave me. Go on.
Don't like
do the fifth episode on your own. Thank you. This show was recorded at a social distance and according to COVID guidelines.